Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to Bokomi. The OMI in Bokomi stands for the original memorable insights that we find in books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture.
I'm Angus Fletcher, author of Wonderworks, and this is my OMI for Book OMI.
This week, we're sharing OMI with a man who literally puts the OMI in Bokomi like no author I've ever met, mapping the genesis and evolution of literature from clay tablets to digital screens, showing how the science of storytelling has invented solutions for being human in the same way that the wheel helped us to move forward and the jet engine helped us to fly.
It's always been from the beginning a tool for humans to get more out of life by getting more out of our own brains.
In Wonderworks, Literary Invention and the Science of Stories, dual-trained neuroscientist and Doctor of Literature Angus Fletcher explains why 25 different inventions have used the same enduring technology to make our past, present, and future worth living.
We're interested in stories and characters and plots and worlds and voices, and we're interested in those things not just because they're fun, but because story is the operating system of the human brain.
From Aristotle's Poetics to Mario Puzo's Godfather, he explores why such inventions were needed, how they work on the human brain, and helpfully, where you can find them to make your own life better and more meaningful. Angus Fletcher, welcome to Bokomi.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
When was literature invented, and what job did it do for the reader?
Well, first of all, it was invented before there were readers. And it was invented such a long time ago that we don't even know when it was invented. It probably predates the human species. It probably goes back to Homo erectus, and maybe even before that, a million years ago or more. But what we can say for certain is that by about a little over 4,000 years ago, literature was starting to be written down. And that's where we actually get the word literature. Literature means that which is writ. And as far as its original function, it means it was the same as another word that means that which is writ, which is scripture. And literature's original function was basically to create a sense of wonder, of possibility, of awe, of things happening that we could imagine but not necessarily see. And very quickly from that point on, literature started to develop two functions that were related to that. One was it got overtaken by priests and a kind of ruling class and was used to create a sense of fear and awe at their own power and gods and majesty and rules. Then it was also taken by audiences and used to do things that audiences wanted, such as figure out ways to heal grief or generate courage, or put more love in the world. And so it's always been from the beginning a tool for humans to get more out of life by getting more out of our own brains.
Each chapter deals with a literary invention to solve a problem, a very human problem. For instance, chapter 11 on the problem of heartbreak. Please, can you explain for the listener how reading Emma by Jane Austen or Sense and Sensibility, written centuries ago, will help them make sense of their love life in the real world today?
Well, one important thing I want to say is it doesn't help you make sense of anything. And this goes back to the way in which I think literature works differently than we're taught in school. And I should just say right out here at the top that my work is incredibly controversial. Most literary critics not only do not like my work, but reject it aggressively. And most of my fans come from medicine and science and social work and business and education and other applied fields. But literary critics do not like what I do. And that's because if you go to a typical class, what you're taught to do when you read Emma or another book is find out what it's saying. You're taught to find out what it means, what its themes are or its representations. You interpret it. You have an argument about, oh, this is the way that you should love or that is the way you should love. And what I say is, no, actually what literature does is it works on the mechanics of our brain to shift the way that we feel, to open up new possibilities for action and imagination in our brain. And so in the case of Emma, one of the things that it does is it shifts you out of a more self-involved view of what romance should be. And so a self-involved romance, a view of romance is the people that I love, the person that I choose to marry should be a reflection of my own desires. They should be who I want them to be. And if they're not who I want them to be, then I should try and change them, or I should leave them for somebody else. And there's a literary technology in Emma, which I go into in some detail, which we can actually show shifts your brain and encourages you to love people, not because they're like you, or not because they're like what you want them to be, but because they're different, because they're their own original selves. And that is, of course, the deep story of Emma itself. It's a story about a woman who tries to make all her friends conform to her own view of love, but ultimately learns in the end that they have their own views of love. And the magic of the technology there, which we usually shorthand as free and direct discourse, is this is an invention, not entirely by Austin, but mostly by Austin, which works on our brain to tease apart different centers in our brain and allow us to separate out our feelings of romance from our desire to make the world a kind of reflection of our own egoistic desires.
Are you talking about how maybe the executive function of the brain is in conflict with, say, the more primitive features of the brain, like the amygdala?
Yeah, and in different ways. So one of the most obvious things we always say about Jane Austen is that it's an ironic love story. It's an ironic love story. And what that means is it's doing two things that are very different. The love part of the story is making us swoon and feel romance at the various characters. We want them to get married. We don't want them to get married. And we have these fantasies about what their wedding is going to look like and these beautiful balls and whatnot. And then the ironic part of us is like, oh, this is so silly and so ludicrous. You know, I mean, the dry, sarcastic tone which pervades the narration. And what's happening there is the story is activating two different parts of our brain and pointing them in different directions. And that different activity is allowing us to love differently because it's allowing us to love, but in a more self-reflective way where we have irony about ourselves and we don't take ourselves so seriously as opposed to earlier novels. So the reason that Austen invented this wasn't, she didn't just invent it out of the blue. It's because she'd read earlier novels by Samuel Richardson and other authors, novels such as Clarissa, which don't activate two parts of our brain. They only activate one part of our brain, which is our romantic enthusiasm. And when that part of our brain gets activated, we start to confuse the real world with our own desires. This is the Don Quixote effect, where you start to think everything I read is actually real, and you don't have that kind of sense of ironic separation and ironic distance. What happens is if you have too much irony, then you leave love entirely. And you can eventually kind of wander into detachment or cynicism or dissociation. But if you have both of them working together in your brain at the same time, there's this marvelous opportunity to love someone for not being you. And Austen realized that's true love. True love is not loving someone because they're exactly who you want them to be. They're loving someone because they're completely different from your expectations. They challenge you. They invite you to grow beyond yourself.
And at the very heart of your book, in terms of the premise for the book and the web that holds it all together, is literature and the book as a technology. And that's why I was immediately and instinctively drawn to your book, when even just from the title, because it's very rare these days, and I say that as somebody who reads a lot of books, that people engage with books in a scientific way or see them as a technology or in a tool of engagement with society or themselves. They're often seen at the moment or in modern times as an escape from reality, especially with fiction. And the notion of the book as a technology is so exciting. I can see why it's controversial, having been raised myself on F.R. Leavis and Louis Althusser and the Marxists and the formalists and having suffered under the weight of Clarissa and taught in that way as a, you know, from the standard literary critics. I just wish your book was around when I was studying English literature as a student, because it would have solved a lot of problems for me in terms of my own state.
Yeah, and this is the thing. The book is ultimately student-centered. The goal of the book is it's built out of, in the way that science sometimes has this reputation of coming in and telling everybody what's right and what's wrong. It's actually the opposite. Science is a democratic method which comes in and says, what was your experience? And everything in this book was built out of talking to readers about their psychological experience. Here's how they responded. Here's why they read these books. And we went deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into that. And you're right, that's completely different from the way that we're taught to read today. I mean, the way that we're taught to read today, either outside of school, we read for escapism or fantasy or fun or something like that. And that's actually not very healthy for us, because what ends up happening is when we leave fantasy and come back to the real world, there's this very rude reentry and we become dissatisfied with the real world. And we also start to feel disempowered. We start to feel, well, the only way to be happy is to escape from the real world. And this is sort of a version of taking a drug or being one of the opium eaters in the Odyssey, if you will. And then what we're taught in school is essentially the way that they read books in the Middle Ages. Because what they did in the Middle Ages is they read the Bible and they said, oh, the stories aren't really what it's about. It's about morality. It's about truth. You know, we have to figure out what justice is. And to do that, we have to use this thing known as interpretation. And interpretation is the application of symbolic logic to language. And so what you do is you learn to put this enormous emphasis on the words on the page. And you spend all this time interpreting the words and what they mean. And then you write these themes. And no one does that normally as a reader. And that's because the human brain is actually not particularly interested in logic. We're interested in stories and characters and plots and worlds and voices. And we're interested in those things, not just because they're fun, but because story is the operating system of the human brain. This was one of the things I realized when I started working in neuroscience and that nobody talks about nowadays. Everyone talks about story as a tool for communication. Nobody asks, why is story such a powerful tool for communication? Why? It doesn't make any sense, because you would think that the human brain evolved in a world where we were getting data in through our eyes and whatnot. You would think that the human brain would be more convinced by logic than it actually is. Why is it so convinced by story? It's because the human brain thinks in story. Why does the human brain think in story? Well, because story is having a plot. It's having a plan. It's having a strategy. When we get up in the morning, what we do is we plan our day. We create a narrative of where we're going. When we think about who we are as societies, we tell a story about where we came from. So the human brain is this story-driven thing because the technology of the human brain is story. And when you realize that, and you realize that literature is this enormously experimental place for using story in different ways, you realize it's a place for using the operating system of the human brain in different ways. And when you start to put that together, you say, here is this software which has been invented specifically to run on our hardware. And it can make our hardware do anything it can do better. And so instead of going to school and being taught morality, or instead of just having fun, you can actually improve your performance, your mental performance.
I love that analogy of software and hardware and language and words and literally the physicality of the book and the code of language within the physical binding of the book. Like you and like anyone who loves stories and structures and layered stories, I'm thinking back to the development of the brain, because from your point of view, from your neuroscientific point of view, the brain hasn't changed that much since the time of the ziggurat. Brain hasn't changed. So how have stories changed? Is it because one literary invention and technology builds upon the next? Why didn't we just start with what we have now?
Yeah, this is a great question. Well, of course, I mean, the short answer to that is human hands haven't changed, but the technology we build with our hands have changed. Because we have learned over time to solve more and more and more and more problems. And what literature started out doing was it started to solve some of the fundamental problems of life. Those are the most urgent problems we felt. And so the most urgent problems when you think about life are the need to find purpose in the day. And we humans, even though we're taught in school that we find purpose through values and ideas and things like that, we actually don't. We find purpose through something known as spiritual experience, through a feeling that something is more, through a feeling that we are part of something bigger. And the most basic way to do that is to connect people to a narrative which is bigger than themselves. To say, hey, you're part of this story which includes gods and giants. You know, you can walk on mountains like your ancestors did. And in the future, you will strive through Valhalla or whatever kind of paradise you want to imagine. So the first and most basic function is just to give us and our narrative brains a sense of emotional purpose. But then beyond that, and some of the earliest technologies I talk about in the book, we need courage. Why do we need courage? Life is really hard. life is really scary. We sort of try to avoid that in the modern world by building this illusion that life can be more stable or more regulated than it really is. But life is at its core highly unpredictable, highly volatile, highly uncertain, and you need to be brave. You just need to be brave on a root level to get up and face the day. And what else do you need? Well, another basic thing you need is love. You need love, and you don't always get love from the people in your life. It would be great if every day you got up and you got love from the people in your life, but you don't. And maybe you don't because they're too busy or something else is happening. And so books evolved to give us love. And so they started with these kind of basic things. And then as I talk about in the book, they evolve over time to do more and more complex and intricate things, from helping us process not just one, but two different types of trauma. Books can actually help you make your own dreams come true. When I say that to people, they think I've just completely lost my mind, but it's because books help refine something known as counterfactual thinking, which is an actual process in your brain through which you actually are able to dream the future and then create it. So it's that process, just like any technology, of becoming more sophisticated over time. And as it becomes more sophisticated, we learn more about what it can do, and we can use it to solve more and more and more problems.
Like any technology, the power of literature depends on its use and its users. Has literature's power declined over the years in terms of being a tool for change? I'm referring to the way that books, as we mentioned, are often just, you could say, misused as escapism, but you also make the point that if we escape together, they serve a very important function of solving loneliness, because we're doing it together. But do you think the power of literature as a technology has declined in the past, I don't know, 30 years?
Yeah, I think it's under threat. I mean, the main reason I wrote the book is because I basically feel like we've lost our sense of all the things that literature can do for us. And it's just sort of like if the most powerful technology that was ever invented was just sitting idly in a corner of your garage and you weren't using it anymore. And that decline of use has been driven by a few things. One of them is that we live in a world now of professional story manufacturers such as Disney. And what they have done is they have over-refined story in the way that certain food producers have over-refined sugar, just to hit certain hedonic zones in our brain. And as I talk about in the book, that's incredibly unhealthy. It gives us these short-term moments of hope and joy that over time are not sustainable and actually drag us away from hope and happiness. So there is a kind of predatory storytelling in the marketplace which has taken over. Our schools, as I've talked about, are something of a disaster. They don't actually teach story in literature. They teach themes and representations and all these non-narrative elements. They teach what they call meaning. And so in school, we just don't understand how to use stories. So we're in this marketplace filled with a lot of unhealthy stories. We're not being kind of taught how to use stories. And then, you know, we're surrounded with this obsession that we have now with computers and other kinds of technology, which actually run on fairly non-human processes. And the more we think of computers as the ideal form of technology, the more we demote the importance of emotion and narrative and these other things which stories can do, which computers can't do. And the more we trap ourselves in this world of burnout and anxiety and anger and all these negative processes, because we're looking to the wrong tools to help us. And so what I basically say in the book is, if you suffer from anxiety or anger, or you just want more joy or hope in your life, there are very, very simple, enduring, sustainable, powerful ways to get them from literature. We should be being taught them in school. We're not, but you can teach them to yourselves. Just pick up this book and start to do the same thing you would do in terms of changing your diet if all you were doing was eating candy bars. Stop just eating candy bars. It's not bad to eat a couple candy bars, but just don't eat all candy bars and start to fold in this other literature. And once you see how it works, you can start to get even more benefits from it. So you're working in tandem with it to maximize its benefits. And that allows us to go back to what our ancestors discovered when literature was the only technology, before medicine, before the combustion engine, when literature was all they had. We can go back to those days when literature was enough, and then, of course, add that to all the new technologies that we have and just have a more sustainable existence.
It's created a philosophical dilemma for me. It sparked so many ideas in me in reading through the stories and the inventions, and I can see why certain literary critics take issue with your model, because it kind of blows apart a lot of literary theory. I have a teenage daughter who was thinking of studying English literature and mathematics, something that I just wouldn't have thought of doing when I was younger. I thought, wow, I really want her to read your book. It's exactly the kind of fresh approach that you need to be talking about English literature. But I hesitated to share it with my own daughter because I thought that it might actually distract her from the point of getting results.
Well, I mean, at the center of the book is a very dangerous idea. And, you know, that dangerous idea isn't just dangerous in terms of the way that we currently teach. It's potentially dangerous to the first adopters. I mean, you know, you see this all the way through when there are innovative ideas. I mean, if you want to go back to the 19th century in Britain, or even before that, back to Newton's time. Let's go back to Newton's time. I mean, Newton basically had to teach himself math. He had to teach himself the math that he used to develop his theory of gravity by buying books that his teachers did not want him to read. Newton's whole theory of physics came from books that were essentially not allowed in the curriculum because they were considered to be wrong and inappropriate. And almost any generation within the academy has had to find change by going outside the curriculum. And there's always that rocky period where people are fighting to change the curriculum from outside, because as anyone who works in educational systems will tell you, they have enormous inertia. The teachers essentially just want to reproduce their own knowledge over and over again. And the reason that I think differently is because I just come at this from a very different angle. I was trained in neuroscience, and then very weirdly, I went into literature, which is not a normal thing for neuroscientists to do, especially not nowadays. And so I kind of am fighting against both of these different elements of my own education. So yes, it is dangerous inside of school, but I will say that outside of school, people are becoming very energized in unexpected ways by this. I mean, I am now training U.S. Special Operations. I'm training some of the most elite operators in the world. Why is it? Because literature holds the key to psychological resilience and fast adaptability and being able to imagine. It's not just a kind of abstractly useful technology. It's not just something that you can kind of sit around in your living room with. It's actually something you can go out into the most contested and volatile spaces because it teaches original thinking. I'm working with a lot of very large companies and corporations. I'm working with a lot of social workers. I work with a lot of veterans groups. I work with a lot of trauma survivors. So I work outside of the established educational curriculum. And I think, honestly, that's where the uptake is going to have to happen. I just don't think it takes schools hundreds and hundreds of years to change. Hundreds. If you're ever within, I mean, they were still teaching Aristotelian logic in the 17th and 18th century in schools. I mean, the medieval curriculum endured in Britain through the 19th century. So I just think, absolutely, I would not say to a student, read this book and then try and write a paper on it. That might be dangerous. I would instead say to someone who's in a position of power, read this book and maybe try and change the curriculum.
What school of literary criticism would you put yourself in if you had to?
It's just fascinating because technically, what I am allied with is what's known as narrative theory. And narrative theory is this rogue group, this rogue tradition that emerged. And I talk about it a little bit at the end of the book. It emerged in the mid-20th century as a rejection of something known as New Criticism. And New Criticism was this way of reading. The most famous illustration of it is called close reading. It was developed by a Cambridge professor, actually an adjunct at the time, in the late 1920s and 1930s. His name was I.A. Richards. And he had this idea, which is, let's apply symbolic logic to literature. And this has become the cornerstone of all literary education for the last 100 years in one way or another. Even when New Criticism was overturned, and even, you know, in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, it still was all about interpretation. It was all about applying symbolic logic to words. It was about semiotics. Well, the moment I just had a realization that this wasn't going to work is when I realized that that's what computers do. Computers run entirely on symbolic logic. That means that in theory, a computer should be able to read all literature and tell us everything about it. And in fact, I.A. Richards says this. He says, in the future, we're going to develop an automated machine which does all this stuff. So I actually started working a little bit in AI. I was fascinated by this. And it turns out, of course, that computers cannot at all read or understand literature or do anything with it. They can generate infinite amounts of meaning. They can develop all these data clouds. They can do exactly what literary critics are doing now. Computers can replace modern literary criticism. But that only goes to show that symbolic logic and semiotics and interpretation are not helpful. And we also know this, by the way, from a phenomenon known as deconstruction and post-structuralism, which occurred in the kind of mid-20th century, where a bunch of scholars like Jacques Derrida and whatnot turned interpretation against itself and proved that it didn't work. So anyway, there's been this huge, you know, interpretation has been everything. But then quietly, there were a group of people who said, no, what if actually literature is about story? And story, I don't know if we have time for it on this podcast, but I can prove to you that story cannot be interpreted.
No, crack on.
I can prove that story has a completely different operating system than logic. And they said, well, what if it's about story? And that would make sense because when people read, they're actually more interested in story than they are in the other things. And story includes characters and it includes events. It includes the worlds, the rules of action. And story, of course, includes the narrator, the style and the voice of the story. What if that's what's actually what's going on? So this rogue group started out and they became the narrative theorists. And I actually didn't discover them until very late in my career. I did this kind of crazy thing where I did neuroscience and then I went to Yale and annoyed everyone at Yale in the English department there. And then I got my first job at Stanford and started working with Pixar and all these people, annoyed everyone at Stanford. And finally, I got this phone call from the middle of nowhere, a phone call from Ohio State University, which is where I now work. And they said, hey, we're this bastion of what's known as narrative theory. And we think that you're doing the same thing as us, only you're doing it from the perspective of neuroscience. And we're doing it from a kind of different thing. Do you want to come join in our think tank? And so I came and I kind of brought the neuroscience and we're now doing all this work here. So I'm technically what's known as a rhetorical narrative theorist, although that ended up being something of an accident because it just ends up being that rhetorical narrative theory and neuroscience converge on the same point.
That ability, that uniquely human ability to learn from the past, live in the present and imagine the future together is what literature can, as a technology, embrace and utilize. So as we give more and more of our future to machine intelligence, I think you've kind of answered that question in that it doesn't take the wonder out of storytelling. I suppose the wonder is the wonder is ours to lose, isn't it? If we rely too much on AI to predict the future or to run our lives or our creativity or our stories, then we're going to lose the wonder. It's the wonder that we lose.
Yeah, well, let me say something that you might think is totally crazy. And this is the part where I lose most people because they're like, this is just too nuts. I think that there are two different kinds of machines. I think there are machines that run on logic and there are machines that run on story. So I think the human brain is a machine. And I think we could build a machine that runs on story that is not a human. So I don't think there's anything special or magical or mystical about the human brain. I mean, science shows us. It's just that we are confusing computers because we think that logic is the only way to be a machine. And we think that logic is the only way to see the world. And we know this is an error because logic is the basis of medieval science. It didn't work in the Middle Ages and it's not going to work now. And it's not going to work for a very simple reason, which is that logic exists in the mathematical present and it assumes that everything is timeless. And what it uses to establish this kind of fake timelessness is data. And when you feed data into a computer, what it becomes able to do is perfectly predict yesterday. It's basically able to say, tomorrow, if tomorrow is exactly the same as yesterday, then it will be like this. So it assumes that everything follows this timeless pattern. And that's actually not the way that the world works. The world is dynamic. It changes. It evolves over time. And this is why AI is largely a boondoggle. If you work closely with AI, as I have done and continue to do, I work on a lot of fairly top projects. We can talk about those if you're interested. You just know it breaks all the time. Why does it break all the time? Well, it breaks for the same reason, which is that AI basically uses statistics. Statistics requires huge amounts of information. It gets more and more brittle the smaller and smaller and smaller its data set is. That's why information and data has become such a prized commodity in our modern world. That's why corporations will pay so much for it and they'll steal it from you when you're not looking. But even no matter how much data corporations get or steal, it's still largely useless in a world of change because that data expires immediately the moment the system changes. And so in order for AI and data to work, in order for these corporations to work, they have to create these rigged systems that don't change. So, you know, a communist regime or a capitalist monopoly, somewhere where they basically say, this is the way it's always going to work. We're going to impose this always working. And we just know from biology, we know from Darwin, we know from Clausewitz, that life is about asymmetric conflict, and asymmetric conflict causes change. There's always going to be change, as long as there are humans. If you deleted humans and removed us all and you just had a world of computers, there would be no change and they would be perfectly happy. But as long as you're going to have humans, you're going to have something which computers cannot predict because they can only use data and logic. And then you have to say, okay, what's actually the way to predict the future? Well, the answer is not to predict it, to make it, to create it. The way to predict the future is to create the future. How do you create the future? You plot. You strategize, you tell a story of the future, and then you make that story come real. And that storytelling machinery is the different machinery of the human brain. That's the machinery that literature plugs into. That's why it gives us this huge performance boost. That's why computers can't read it and will never be able to read it, because logic and story are fundamentally different mechanisms. You cannot put them together. There is no way for a computer to process story ever. And it's also why your brain is terrible at processing logic. Your brain story just doesn't handle large amounts of data. It just doesn't. That's why you get very confused and overwhelmed as a human if you get told two or three things, more than two or three things. You just get overwhelmed. They're just different operating systems. And so it's okay to have a machine future as long as that machine future involves multiple kinds of machine, logic and story, and then maybe others as well.
Your chapter on renewing the future by relearning the past feels particularly relevant today as old political and cultural wounds are opened up by populism and nationalism and narratives of the past. Do you think it's possible for an entire nation to relearn its past through literature? Can literature solve big collective problems in the national consciousness?
Well, it has in the past. Absolutely. I mean, there are always these books. I mean, that chapter talks about 100 Years of Solitude, which has been a story which has allowed not just one nation, but honestly, a collective of nations in South America to start to rethink their history. And absolutely, the power of literature is the power that we give it. The difference between literature and, say, religion or something like that is religion tries to compel us. Religion says, this is true. You must believe this story. You must believe that this man died in this way or that this God came down from this mountain or whatever. Literature just gives us the opportunity to come together and say, this story works. This story is an effective story. It's a happier story. It's a more effective story. It helps us grow in ways that we want. And in many, many situations across history, people have come together to embrace those narratives, to embrace those stories, stories of healing, stories of hope, stories of optimism. And so absolutely we could do it again. It just requires us to let go of the things that stand in the way of literature. The main thing that stands in the way of literature is just the desire to be right, the desire to judge. These are the things that lead us to not forget things. These are also the things that lead us to be anxious about embracing a fiction. I mean, if I said to you, you would have happier relationships if you told yourself this story, and you said, well, I can't tell myself a story that's not true, that's the place where we're at right now. Because people say, well, you know, I don't want to be a pragmatist. I want to be someone who has the truth. And in general, I would say to them, that's great. I mean, I would like to be someone who knows the truth too, but here's the problem, the human brain can't know it. And so at some point we have to have this moment of reckoning where we've tried to find the truth. We've tried to find it through logic. We've tried to find it through all these different ways. And what we've arrived at instead is a world where we have science and we have art. Science doesn't give us the truth. It can't. Epistemologically, it gives up on the truth. Instead, what it does is it gives us useful medicines and technologies and methods for exploring and enriching our lives. And it's the same thing with art. No one ever goes to Hamlet and says, well, that wasn't true. I mean, there was never this prince in Denmark. And why is he speaking English anyway? People go and say, I go to this play because it helps me grieve. It helps me process my own emotions, my own feelings. And this is what it means to be a tool. A tool is not true or false. A tool is not right or wrong. A tool is just something useful. A tool is something made. Something made is known as a fictum in Latin, which is where we get our word fiction from. So if we want to start seeing literature not as scripture, not as true, not as giving us morals and principles, but instead as a tool for helping us empower ourselves and enrich ourselves. That's where the shift will come from. But again, to do that, we just have to shift our consciousness away from what we're being taught in school. And this desire that people have to defend literature by endlessly insisting that it's true. I have so many conversations with people about Shakespeare, and they say, oh, it's universal. These are just universal themes and universal truths. And if Shakespeare had thought that way, you know what he would have written? He would have written the allegories of the Middle Ages, and no one would read it. Because actually, what Shakespeare is about is the weird, the idiosyncratic. It's about conflict. It's about emotion and passion. These are all non-logical, non-true things. They don't devalue the truth. They don't reject the truth. They just exist in a different sphere of activity. And so we have to have the courage. And this is really where it comes down to. Are we courageous enough to leave the safety, the fake safety, but nevertheless the feeling of safety, of data, of truth? Are we courageous enough to leave the psychology of the Middle Ages, where we had to believe in justice and God? And can we embrace the Renaissance? Can we embrace a new way of thinking, which is about the opportunity ahead, and also about humanity and what makes us human? And all those things that make us human are emotions, our stories, not right and wrong, not justice, not those things. And so if we're willing to do that, then yes, literature can change everything.
Angus Fletcher, thank you for sharing your OMI with Book OMI today.
Thank you, Richard. It has been an honor and a privilege to be here.
WonderWorks, Literary Invention and the Science of Stories can be purchased from our independent bookselling partner, Primrose Hill Books. Just follow the link in the episode description. If you'd like more Book OMI, please like and subscribe to the Book OMI cast on your Apple, Spotify or audio platforms, and follow us at Book OMI on Twitter or Instagram. There's even a Facebook page if you're that way inclined. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe, curious and always learning. Bye for now.
I love Book OMI.